Welcome to Worker Movement, a podcast dedicated to the working class, a podcast dedicated to raising class consciousness. This podcast is for you, for us, for the worker.
The Derek Chauvin versus the state of Minnesota trial concluded its first week of the prosecution's case against the Minneapolis cop charged with second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree depraved mind murder, and second-degree manslaughter relating to the death of George Floyd. This episode covers the events of Day 3, 4, and 5 of the trial, which is Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. While summarizing each day's testimony, we discuss wage theft, opioid addiction, and the state of the blue wall. So on Day 3, we concluded the testimony of the off-duty Minneapolis firefighter. She returned to the stand after getting yelled at by the judge. The defense asked her literally one question, which was, did you have your badge? She answered no. The prosecution then did a redirect. And the question was, did you know if the fire department was called? And she said no, and that was the end of her testimony. So she got recalled for another day for literally 4 minutes of testimony after the judge yelled at her. This doesn't really have any bearing on anything, but it kind of paints the picture of what the system is imposing on witnesses. There was no reason to yell at this individual, and there was no reason to yell at, and there was no reason to have her recalled for literally 4 minutes of testimony to spend the next 16 hours thinking about getting yelled at by a judge so that she can answer two trivial questions that are going to have absolutely no bearing on the case. The next witness called was an 18-year-old who was the convenience store cashier. The day started, and this witness basically laid this out, where George Floyd came in, he attempted to buy cigarettes with a fake 20. The cashier testified that he held up the 20 and knew it was fake, but he let it slide anyway. He then went and told his manager that it was fake, and the manager told him to go out and talk to George Floyd about it at his car. So this 18-year-old cashier ended up walking out to George Floyd's car with another coworker and was basically like, hey, your money's counterfeit, come back into the store. There were two other individuals in the car, we learned. One was a male and another was a female in the back seat. They basically said, no, we're not going to come in. So the cashier was like, okay. So he went back to the store, told his manager. At this time, he testified that he said, I'll just cover the $20 bill cost. The manager sent him back out again to talk. George Floyd and the people in the car didn't return to the store. At this point in time, the manager called the police. The important part about this, as it relates to our theme, is that the store had a policy where if you took a counterfeit $20 bill, you had to cover the cost of it. This is wage theft. This is blatantly illegal. So the entire premise by which the employee even raised the issue, which led to the manager calling the police, happened because workers are exploited and literally having their wages stolen because they have an obligation to report counterfeit money. So you have this very near minimum wage worker. I have no idea what he was getting paid, but it can't be excessive. Responsible and effectively tasked by his job to police counterfeit money. He testified later that he had absolutely no training and was just doing it on his own. He didn't have the little marker. He said that he just knew it was fake, and I'm guessing it was something fairly obvious. I don't think there's any reason to dispute that the $20 bill that George Floyd provided was in fact counterfeit, but he did raise the question of whether George Floyd actually knew it was counterfeit.
You know, that's a great point, is that he's being accused of a crime that he may or may not have even committed. What's really interesting about all this, and the crazy part, is that the store not only had to say, well, we have to make it a policy that if you don't follow the guidelines, you have to pay the money back, even though we were told that there was no guidelines. They just had to steal their money from the employee, which is really wild to me.
The store came out with a press release shortly after this testimony. Was basically like, whoa, we're not doing this. And it's like, the fact that you just did a PR is basically establishing that, yes, this is literally your policy and you have a need to clarify it legally.
This is our policy, but it's not our policy. You know what I mean? There were some really interesting just side comments here when this young man was speaking, which is like, he talked to his mom on the cell phone, telling it to come down. You know, he's basically living with regret for the fact that he's responsible for the death of a person. So if you think about this, this young man forced because of wage theft to essentially police the working class or the poor with the fraudulent money is now responsible for the loss of human life because he ultimately is the one that spilled the beans or told his manager, what do you want to say, essentially putting George Floyd's life in danger because now the cops have been called. And this is something he has to live with, and there's guilt everywhere from it.
What was going through your mind during that time period?
Disbelief. Thank you.
Why guilt?
If I would have just not taken the bill, this could have been avoided.
So this is an 18-year-old kid that has to bear this burden for the rest of his life because the police showed up and killed somebody over a $20 bill. This general concept of guilt is parallel to the individual that testified earlier who filmed the bystander video. She stays up at night and has to wonder, you know, what could she have done to help George? The prosecution is attempting to establish that this collection of individuals that were watching are deeply impacted by this outcome, and that'll become relevant later. So his testimony ends, and the next individual that testifies, his testimony is generally not that important, but it did allow a couple videos to be entered into the record. So this is an individual that drove up behind George Floyd's car, started filming video when the cops came over. The situation got a little hairy, so he basically did a U-turn, went to the other side of the street, and then resumed filming. He watched George Floyd walk across the street, and then the cops effectively started putting him in the SUV, so he drove past. That was the extent of his testimony. The next individual, and this is a little bit more relevant, is by a bystander named Charles McMillan. He's a black male, age of 60, and he watched almost the entire event. And he's the individual that can be heard saying, "You can't win, just get in the car, just stand up." He understood that the system was completely fucked and was attempting to direct George Floyd in his state of distress to just comply with the police because he understood that that was the path of least escalation. And so he was an advocate the entire video.
When I drive, and you can, if you're in the car with me, you'll know this, when I see a cop, there's something else I pay attention to on the road. It's not the road anymore. It's what the action of the cops are going to do. They follow me. They're going to pull up behind me. They're going to pull me over. And this is a real thing, and this happens all the time. There's ways you talk to your kids, and there's ways you talk to people that you know about how to interact with cops. And this older gentleman was trying to help somebody out because at the end of the day, you know, you can't win because they have a gun. They have the authority to kill you is what it comes down to, and he knew it. And ultimately is what happened.
At the end of his testimony, video was introduced of Charles McMillan talking to Chauvin after the entire event happened.
One of the voices was saying something to the effect of, I don't respect what you did, or something like that. Was that your voice or Mr. Chauvin's voice?
My voice.
Okay. And was Mr. Chauvin's voice the other voice on that?
Yes.
And what were you trying to do at that point in time when you were talking to Mr. Chauvin? Why did you feel the need to talk to Mr. Chauvin?
Because what I watched was wrong.
And did you feel it was important to tell him that?
Yes, ma'am.
This was just evidence of this individual caring about what happened. And it attempted to increase empathy among the jury that this individual deeply cared about what happened and was bothered by it. He wasn't a bystander for the fame. He didn't in any way, shape, or form during the event threaten anybody. He was attempting to de-escalate, and I think that was the intent of his testimony. And it was also the first time the jury heard Chauvin's voice in his own body camera video after the event occurred. So I think there was some intentional strategy there, too.
The prosecution has had a good job laying out the prosecuting witness strategy in a way that's escalating this into a, here's a damage done on the bystanders. And these are bystanders, like we had the MMA fighter, we had the store person, we had just random bystanders, we had the firefighter, right? Now we're moving into experts in the field that were actually part of the scene. And you're going to see that the defense is going to spend all their time trying to basically maneuver that, yeah, Chauvin may have been wrong, but there are some circumstances that cause this, like the crowd and, you know, he was trained in this way and he was fighting back and there was a history of drug use. They're trying to get all the classic tropes going.
So the final witness of day three was a lieutenant named James Rugel. And he is employed by the Minneapolis Police Department. And he's largely, I'm going to say, in the IT field. And he's in charge of body camera footage and just managing some of the infrastructure around body cameras. His testimony was largely used as a predicate to introduce the body cameras from the four police officers involved in this act. And the prosecution actually played each of the body cameras back to back to back to back. And I believe this was the first time that Chauvin's body camera was shown. They watched the same video from like 3 feet apart, four times.
There's nothing the defense can really do at this point in time.
if you had never seen these videos before, and for the most part, the jury has literally only seen the bystander video because it was displayed in the opening statement, to sit through this successively and watch this for 40 minutes is like an absolutely radicalizing thing, I have to imagine. I've seen these videos. They've been around. Like, this didn't really, like, it wasn't like this big emotional thing because I'd already seen them. But for the jury, it had to have just been like, holy shit. And it does kind of lay out the pretense of the cops using excessive force. When George Floyd is originally arrested, the officer points a gun at him and he basically panics. The jury would have seen that for the first time. And he got a gun drawn on him for allegedly counterfeiting a $20 bill. That seems excessive, right?
Yeah, that's $20 bill. That's so fucking wild. I mean, the bullets and everything about that cop cost more than $20. I mean, think about it in the terms of overreaction. You had how many cops show up for this?
4. And then you had a billion later once the scene had to be, like, secured and cars towed and evidence gathered. So much money.
Aside from the fact that somebody was murdered, right? Think about just the overreaction of policing itself. How does this even help society? It doesn't. It only helps a landowner. It only helps the landowner here, the basically slave driver who was forcing his employee to police money.
The manager of Cup Foods literally called the police, and the police showed up to serve the interests of that restaurant, convenience store, whatever you want to call it. They weren't serving the public interest at that point in any way, shape, or form. When you factor in the cost, some of the video footage later shows that they left the cop car running for basically like 4 hours, just parked idling.
Then they had to tow it.
And then they had to tow it. And it's like the cost of just the gas and then towing it exceeds the $20 in counterfeit. It just wild. So this witness exists to enter body cam evidence, and you get to watch the entire video 4 times in a row. And it's an enduring emotional thing for, I think, most of these jurors. The witness didn't offer anything substantial. They were completely unrelated to the scene. They were responsible for the chain of custody of the police body cameras. That was their reason for existing. And that was the end of day 3. There was a little bit of procedural stuff with the witness that happened outside of the jury.
All right, this is day 4. This is actually, the whole day is actually pretty intense when it comes to the medical field, right? I mean, it's really, really, really about now painting this picture that George was a nice guy and the cops killed him.
The first witness on day 4 is George Floyd's girlfriend, Courtney Ross. And she's largely used as a mitigating witness, because drug use is going to come up and she's able to empathetically discuss their drug use. She states that they're both addicted to opioids, and that's the reason why fentanyl and methamphetamine is involved in this, because they are addicted, and if they can't get pharmacy grade opioids, they're buying from the street. So that explains why George might have had fentanyl in his system to some degree. And it's the first example that the jury observes that says George Floyd was on drugs, and it's through a favorable witness to George Floyd because it was George Floyd's girlfriend. So there's an intentional strategy to this.
And so the defense is basically left with a witness that says, we did drugs, maybe in the system, and this is who he is. He didn't go out that day looking for a fight, and he didn't go out that day trying to fight cops. He went out that day to basically get some smokes.
Yeah, it's an attempt to convey that Floyd used drugs, but that he wasn't a junkie. He had a back injury and he got addicted to opioids. He's not a bad guy. He's not some thug that's going by and doing drive-bys, which is another appeal to the angry black man trope the defense is eager to bring up. She did state that he had a heroin overdose and was hospitalized for 5 days, but he recovered and stopped using for some period of time prior to May when he relapsed, if I'm remembering the timeline correctly. There was some discussion about March pills and May pills and how some of these pills were different and they made them feel differently. She doesn't know where the pills came from, but she guessed that the individual that was in the front seat of the car during the entire interaction, his name was Maurice Hall, he'll appear later on, was allegedly his dealer. Her whole entire testimony is about saying that, yes, we used drugs, but he wasn't a bad guy. And it's an appeal to the jury to say Floyd did not deserve this.
It basically humanized drug use in a way that wasn't some expert on the stand saying, well, people that use drugs aren't bad. It's basically saying, as a character witness, he wasn't a bad person and we just happened to use drugs. One of the key, parts of this testimony is that one layout about how you hurt yourself, You're looking for recovery, you get addicted to opioids, and now all of a sudden there's rules in place or there's laws in place that prevent you from getting the opioids that you need. Because as we know, opioid usage means that you're trying to numb some pain, and over time your body becomes accustomed to it, so you need a higher and higher dose. And the idea that you get a overdose, especially this heroin overdose, is generally what happens is somebody goes into treatment and they try to kick the habit. So they try to kick heroin, let's say. Then they get out of treatment and they go and they have a relapse. But they relapse with the doses they're on when they're at the peak of their drug use before treatment. And now they OD because now they're hitting too hard. Then now they're left with the scars of overdosing. So they're going out and trying to find pills or some other form of opioids. And they're stuck in this vicious cycle of trying to score drugs.
So it's not necessarily they need their fix. They're chemically dependent and they can't endure withdrawals because they don't have the medical support that they need.
It's really intense withdrawals from heroin or other opioids. And I think people that are withdrawing are going to choose to be a little high than not high at all, going through the cramping and all the stress that goes along with trying to kick the habit cold turkey.
You can't quit opioids cold turkey. Like, it just functionally doesn't work that way, right?
You should not try to quit cold turkey. Fundamentally, there's a problem if you try doing it. Your body is not going to love what you're doing to it. Absolutely.
Most people that become addicted to heroin use heroin because they are addicted to some pharmaceutical grade opioid. They get cut off. They can't afford their prescriptions, whatever. And the cheapest thing to buy that's opioid on the street is heroin.
Yep. Well, now it's fentanyl too, right?
And now it's fentanyl. But that's the history of opioids. And for the most part, people that use heroin aren't necessarily doing it to get high. They're literally taking the least amount that they can to maintain their chemical dependency without having withdrawals. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement because withdrawals are not something you want. In fact, let me read off. So you're addicted to painkillers because that's how you manage your pain. We're not judging you for being addicted to them. It happens to a lot of people because of the way pharmaceutical grade opioids are created, pushed to you, right? So what happens if you withdraw, all right? There's fever, cravings, right? Mood changes. So, I mean, imagine getting a fever because you need something and you can't get it. And the only way to fight it is to get what you can't have, right? Heroin cravings. Having a craving so intense that you'll do anything to get the fix. And that's what we talk about, like, quote unquote, the junkie, right? People who just need to get a fix or get their craving taken care of. They're basically having heroin cravings or any cravings at all, in which it's almost to the point of like hunger, right? You have to eat, you got to drink. I mean, it's the same idea. So mood changes. Well, we talked about how the gun was pulled on Floyd. He had basically a panic attack at that point in time. We're talking about mood changes, depression, anxiety, irritableness. You can actually get aches and pains. Now you're getting that full blast, you know, reality of what your nerves are feeling. You can get bloating because you're not processing enough, diarrhea, stomach pain, nausea, and vomiting, restlessness and sleep problems. And all it all means that it's a cycle, right? So really, the question becomes, you know, what is the minimum I can take to not have these symptoms happen to me? And if you're cut off for a day or two, I mean, you're going to go do whatever you can to get this because you know the pain you're going to have.
And this speaks more to the fucked up state of American healthcare than it does to the moral failings of any individual addicted to opioids. Again, this is another example of the entire system exposing a problem that had opioid addiction not been a thing and some asshole doctor wrote a script that this person got addicted to, none of this would have happened.
None of this would have happened.
The next two witnesses are the two paramedics that arrive at the scene. You have Seth Ravender. He was effectively the driver at the scene.
Getaway driver, huh?
We learned through his testimony a set of perhaps incomplete facts that later get filled in. For example, he got asked, was George Floyd alive when you got to the scene? And he says, I don't know, because the other paramedic I was with, my partner, was the one that did the pulse check and did the pupil check. So he defers. So he's the driver. So we learned that once they loaded George Floyd, they drove effectively a block away and started cardiac arrest-based treatment. This was something that I don't think anybody knew. They didn't know where the ambulance went. Earlier in the testimony, somebody stated that it didn't make sense the direction that the ambulance went because the hospital was in a different direction. Well, it turns out they were just effectively driving away to get away from the scene. There was a little bit of testimony about how there were some angry people there. Again, built up by the defense as the angry mob, and it was so angry that the EMS had to drive away. This individual talked a little bit about what care was provided. They used a Lucas device, which is a mechanical compression machine that they install over his chest, and it's a plunger that pushes down in your chest to do compressions. They did a throat tube. This witness basically answered all the medical questions correctly, and the defense basically just used him to talk about how the crowd was angry and he had to leave.
Again, this is that trope we're talking about, which is the you know, they asked the firefighter in the first day or second day, what would you do if a crowd was videotaping you? And she's like, nothing. It's what's supposed to happen. So the defense is grasping at straws again.
The next paramedic is then called, and this individual is, I would characterize him as likely being with a military background because he was very formal and just his speech patterns was always saying yes, ma'am, no, ma'am to the prosecuting attorney who was a female.
So this is the pattern, though, where they're switching prosecutors in and out, right? The state has that ability, too.
Yep. There's, I think, 4 or 5 prosecutors that have appeared so far, and it appears as though each of them works with a specific witness and perhaps becomes familiar with the case more directly, and they're compartmentalizing work effectively. And the defense wants you to believe that it's just this one guy doing everything, but he also has a legion of people funded by the police union that are legally doing work on this case as well.
Absolutely. This is not some fly by night. This is a well orchestrated campaign. What's crazy now, and I'm glad you brought the police union, is that the police union have to now tiptoe this line where they gotta protect one of their own, but also protect the system. And I don't know how much of that's theater or how much of that's real. I don't know how much the police union is protecting him versus trying to bury this guy to make it all go away.
The second paramedic, Derek Smith, is very formal, and he is much more direct with questions. He says, when I arrived at the scene, in layman's terms, he was dead. He stated that the original call was for a mouth injury, but it got upgraded. He fills in some of the blanks in the previous testimony. He says, I told my partner I thought he was dead and want to move him. I will begin care in the back. I checked his pulse. He was dead in layman's terms. Those are all just very direct quotes that he stated during his direct examination. There wasn't a lot of wiggle room with anything he said. It was, he was dead. We did this medically. This is what we wanted to do. He raised some of the just pattern of events that occurred while care was being given. He talked about the fire response and how at one point in time, there was an officer in the back of the ambulance, Officer Lane, who was doing chest compressions. And he was very concerned that they just needed more people. So that's why they drove away. They wanted to get to the scene and they wanted fire to be able to show up. Because fire does 80% medical. They don't only fight fires. That's a common misconception. So he wanted fire to show up so that they had more individuals because time was of the essence. It was a key theme as well that time was of the essence. They needed to do this, 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 and this, and they didn't want to be obstructed. Now, the defense made what I think is a fairly critical error during the cross-examination. They asked a question that they didn't know the answer to.
So, officers in the back doing chest compressions, you're getting set up, correct?
Yes, sir.
Went to the second location so that your partner could get back in the back with you to take over for the officer, right?
Not to take over. We needed everybody we could at that time.
Okay. Why didn't you just have the officer help you continue so you could go straight to the hospital?
That's not what we do.
Is it because he's not an EMT?
Any layperson can do chest compressions. There's no reason Minneapolis couldn't have started chest compressions.
That's not my question. My question is, he's not an EMT, correct?
I don't know the level of certification of the individual that got into the back of my rig.
All right. You wanted a partner who could help you out, correct?
I wanted as many people that were willing to help me at that time to work this cardiac arrest.
Right. And that's why fire came, right?
Correct.
And ultimately, the officer was kind of put out of the rig.
Correct.
I have no further questions.
The defense was trying to establish, well, why didn't you just go straight to the hospital? You had an officer in the back. And then the defense just cuts off the rest of their testimony. They're like, yep, we're done here. We have nothing to be gained.
Because you just basically proven that they should have done medical care at the scene.
Yep.
Is that your takeaway too?
Yep.
That was like, oh shit, we fucked up a little bit there because we shouldn't have asked that question.
It effectively proves that nobody was providing medical care at the scene.
But they could have. That's the important part, is that they could have.
Yep. The next witness was Jeremy Norton, and he was a captain for the Minneapolis Fire Department. He responded to the escalation of the medical crisis and showed up. He wandered around the store a little bit because the signaling from dispatch wasn't clear. He eventually rejoined the EMS a block away, and they did medical procedures as they drove to the hospital. Upon getting to the hospital, he was declared dead. After the death occurred, he radioed back to dispatch that says, I want somebody to reach out to the firefighter that was at the scene, who he ran into while he was wandering around at the scene initially. He observed that she was visibly distraught and distressed and wanted to make sure that she was taken care of and any witness testimony or whatever was preserved, because he understood that an individual was killed in police custody. On the day of, he raised that an individual was killed in police custody, and he became concerned by that.
That's a really important statement, because it's one of those little nuances in which you realize that somebody was killed, and now he's killed in police custody, and now he's killed in police custody, but like handcuffed in police custody. It wasn't like he broke the handcuffs and was headbutting everybody and they had to shoot him, right? It was hands behind his back on the ground, killed in police custody. Now it's an issue.
The next witness was a police sergeant who was directly responsible for oversight of Chauvin and the district in which this all occurred. There was a lot of discussion about the use of force, and one of the Minneapolis procedures is that if use of force is to be used, you have to contact your sergeant, who, I guess, signs off on it or in some way, shape, or form kind of oversees the use of force. And his testimony largely centered around what he knew and when he knew it. Throughout the entire incident, this sergeant was really only alerted to the potential use of force by the dispatcher, initially on day one, the very first witness. And he started looking into what she observed. He drove to the scene. He ended up getting to the scene afterwards. He attempted to call Chauvin. Chauvin took a phone call with him with their body cameras off. He attempted to answer what happened while on the phone call. At no point did this sergeant learn that Chauvin was applying this knee to the neck until much, much later in the day.
Like, much, much later, right? Where it was ridiculously longer than it should have been.
Yeah, this officer divulged that he went to the hospital and was there effectively after George Floyd was already pronounced dead. Chauvin and Tao were at the hospital as well, while Officer Lane and King were still at the scene. He had no idea what had happened and presumed that it was a medical emergency because that's what Chauvin told him. So at this point, he's understanding that stuff is being escalated and this is going to be a shit show. And that happened. It became a critical incident. He told everybody involved that this is the protocols we need to follow. He appears to have done everything right from a protocol perspective once he learned of certain information. The controversy during his testimony was that the prosecution wanted him to assert whether the use of force was reasonable or not. And there was a lot of sidebarring, and they had to determine what question could be answered. The prosecution was eventually allowed to ask a question.
Do you have an opinion as to when the restraint of Mr. Floyd should have ended in this encounter?
Yes.
What is it?
When Mr. Floyd was no longer offering up any resistance to the officers, they could have ended the restraint.
And that was after he was handcuffed and on the ground and no longer resisting.
Correct.
So this is the first evidence of a cop saying this was wrong. And this is a theme that we're going to build upon in the coming days.
And that's a very sterile statement, but as soon as he stopped resisting, they could end the restraints. And you hear him saying, you know, I can't breathe. He's at that point in time, he stopped resisting. What else is he going to do? There's nothing else he can do.
Well, he's done resisting because he's dead, right?
He's dead, right? Yep.
You're putting your knee on somebody's neck who's dead. There's no offering of aid.
There's no way to fight back.
Yep. And that's effectively what this officer was saying. The defense during cross-examination went with the angry mob trope. My client couldn't offer aid because there was an angry mob and that affected his decision calculus. During the redirect, the prosecution was very clear to say, should the absence of a pulse weigh into the decision calculus?
Everything was a trap, right? It was a trap every single time because there was nothing, you can't come back from that.
I had to kill the man because there was an angry crowd being mean to me.
Right. Poor little old me with the gun. I had to kill this guy.
So this is the first evidence of a cop basically just attempting to crucify Chauvin. That's the end of day four.
As you pay attention to this, we're gonna hear continuously the same thought processes, right? This cop was a bad apple. This cop did everything wrong. We're trained differently than everybody else. We're good people. Over and over again, you're going to hear that same shit. And because the theme is they're trying to protect as much as they can their own. Police are put in place to control the poor. And you don't get to get out of that system by cheating. So in his case, you don't get to get out of the system by giving away a fake $20 bill. That's not for you to do. No. You're screwing with capital now. But they can't sit by and let somebody kill too much, because if they let you kill too much, then the public will lose trust in them, and that becomes an issue.
Yeah, and in this instance, the overexertion of force was so visibly evident that a police precinct was burned to the ground. that is not good for Capitol and their interests.
Never, right? Never. Because they need it to survive so that then when someone rips them off $20, they can send out an occupying force to wrangle up those that stole $20 from the capitalists.
Yeah.
Essentially what happened, right?
At this phase of the trial, Chauvin is just as much a victim of the police as George Floyd is, because the entire system is built to preserve the police.
Yeah, he's getting railroaded every fucking which way, because there's no reason not to.
Yeah, Chauvin is the biggest threat to the police system, because his entire defense relies on establishing the police as an entity permit this behavior.
Yep, that they go above and beyond their training, that they're all pieces of shit, and this is what you're going to get from them.
And it's a lot easier for the system to just purge a single individual than to look inward.
Absolutely. On to day five, it gets, again, really cop heavy here. And it's because the prosecution is trying to set a certain set of bounds that police do these things, but police don't do these other things. Now, we know it's all bullshit, that police will do anything they can to preserve power. We know that.
So the first witness is a cop, Sergeant John Edwards, and he is the individual that took over the scene, the physical geography in which the murder took place, and secured the scene and collected evidence. And through his testimony, we learned that he was the one that instructed Officer Lane and Officer King to be transported to room 100, which is part of the critical incident protocol. This is the earlier reference where he had to tow a car that had been running all day. There was very little cross-examination. He was effectively just saying what happened. A pretty sterile witness in terms of either side benefiting greatly from it. So the next witness was Lieutenant Richard Zimmerman, and he is currently a homicide detective with the Minneapolis Police Force, and he has been a cop since 1981. He largely was here to discuss use of force because he is often the first on a scene and identifies cause of death. So he has some expertise in identifying what happened. So he is attempting to state what his opinion is as some sort of expert on the matter. He reiterated several times that the amount of force on the neck and use of the knee was totally unnecessary. It was uncalled for. There was no evidence. He said, "I saw no reason why the officers were in danger." When asked whether the restraint should have stopped, he said, "Absolutely." He was very much in the Derek Chauvin did everything wrong camp as a witness. The defense attempted to paint him as not a real cop because he wears street clothes. He doesn't arrest the poors on a daily basis. He hasn't been in a real fight since 2018.
Yeah, that was super fucked up, dude. Like, basically, you're not a real cop because you're not fucking breaking necks like our boy Chauvin is, right? I mean, that's what it comes down to. You can't be a real cop because real cops beat the shit out of poor people. And you don't do that, so go fuck yourself. And again, it's capital preserving capital, it's cops preserving cops. It's the police union needs to throw Chauvin under the bus to preserve itself. If Chauvin gets acquitted, this could be actually be what causes like a reorganization of the Minneapolis Police Department in a way that disrupts those that are already in power. Like, they don't want that. They don't want that heat.
It would be so disruptive for that to happen that they're just going to bury him. And I think that's both of our opinions, that he will be convicted of something because it's the path of least resistance.
Because they have to. He has to be convicted of something.
So during Lieutenant Zimmerman's cross-examination, there's discussion about the critical decision-making model, which we're going to hear from a lot in the coming days. And it's basically...
That's such a stupid fucking model.
It's basically just this idea of you take in circumstantial evidence and you make decisions. It requires cops to think. It's just a very basic... I'm in a situation, I need to assess my surroundings. You're a pilot, you don't want to lose situational awareness. It's the same premise. There was a lot of hypotheticals where the defense was very eager to say, well, what if you were in a gunfight? Could you improvise? Maybe use a knee on somebody's neck? Would that be permissible? And the witness is like, I mean, I guess you could make a hypothetical for that. And it's like, okay, well, what if there was an angry mob? Would that impact your critical decision making? And the guy's like, yes.
I guess, right? Of course. Like, what if you're on fire? Would you run around filling your arms? I don't know. I've never been on fire. But hypothetically, if you're on fire, would you run around or would you stop, drop, and roll? I mean, this is what they're doing.
Yes. They're presenting hypotheticals that are favorable based on how they frame it. And this officer is competent enough to just answer the question as asked. And it's the job of the prosecution on redirect to clarify these questions. So on redirect, I think the prosecution did a decent job and basically asked, should the crowd have had any effect on your actions? And the witness is like, no. He literally said the crowd shouldn't have an effect on your actions. They weren't interfering directly or causing harm to the officers. And then everybody got to go home on Easter Friday. So another thing that happened, and this happened on Thursday, which would have been day 4 into day 5, there was another ruling by the Supreme Court that makes reference to depraved mind murder, which is what Chauvin is charged with. That's third degree murder. And we've talked on previous episodes about how there is some legal nuance in Minnesota as to what this means. So the ruling was caused because some asshole drove his snowmobile into an 8-year-old while he was absolutely shit plastered on alcohol, and he was appealing. And within the opinion, there's a citation to a case called Barnes, which then cites a case called State versus Wahlberg, in which it states that depraved mind murder, on the other hand, cannot occur where the defendant's actions were focused on a specific person. So this has implications in the Chauvin trial because his actions were directed at a single individual, George Floyd. So there's some legal nuance to this mattering.
Yeah, he's not like throwing cherry bombs, you know, over the wall and hitting a group of people and causing third degree murder. He's not throwing shit off like the balcony and killing somebody. He didn't accidentally poison the water stream somehow and people drank it and it wasn't targeted. Like this is a physically targeting, you know, an individual.
And without being too legally nuanced, there's implications where a third degree murder charge might not be the correct charge in this situation because he is targeting a single individual. So were he to be convicted of third degree murder, there's a plausibility that his conviction could be overturned based on this premise that he was only targeting a specific individual. There are a set of existing precedents that are sort of competing, and the latest example is the Knorr case, in which a Minneapolis police officer shot and killed an individual that is being appealed and has been accepted for review by the Minnesota Supreme Court that will have an implication on this concept of targeting a single individual. The facts are slightly different in that case, but it will be closely watched and could result in a Derek Chauvin conviction being overturned, potentially. We don't know, but it's something that's happening in the legal space in Minnesota. Whenever a cop kills somebody, you can make the argument that their actions were directed against a group of people, which is the working class. The statute typically covers you fire a gun into a crowd and you indiscriminately harm somebody. Well, the entire police are indiscriminately harming people, and George Floyd was the person that got shot in the crowd.
Right. The police are always policing the poor because, one, that's the only tools they have, and two, they don't understand the crimes of the rich. So the broken windows crimes are only things they can police because there's no other enforcement mechanism. Because everything else is litigation. It's civil, right? Think about the wage theft of that young man, you know, losing $20 because of the fake bill. What is his recourse? The police aren't going to come and kill the store owner. So essentially, the police are always targeting the poor, and so it's pretty much always third-degree murder.
For future episodes and to learn more about the worker movement, join us at workermovement.com.